argument, please introduce yourself and identify your client before beginning your oral arguments. The appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. And you may proceed at this time. The appellant may proceed. And we're not hearing you.
Mr. Noller is muted.
Apologies, Your Honor.
Hear you fine. Please proceed.
May it please the court, opposing counsel, my name is Dan Kohler, and I represent the appellant, Douglas Miner, in this matter. This appeal, we're asking for the court to reverse the decision of the district court and allow him to withdraw his plea. This is necessary to correct a manifest injustice, and any timing concerns were waived by the state by not raising them at the district court level. So addressing the merits of this appeal is what's appropriate here.
If you think the state has waived, what's the difference between waived or forfeited? Are they the same as it relates to this particular incident?
In terms of the timing, the 2 years isn't a jurisdictional bar, so by not raising it, it's waived. I think that the courts can still take timing into consideration as a relevant factor, but in this case, the judge didn't. The sole issue was the statement that this was a technicality, not of substance.
Well, let's get to the merits of the case, and Mr. Kohler, because I'm somewhat perplexed at how all of this goes down. So is it fair to say that if, in fact, the supervising attorney had co-signed the Rule 15 petition that you would have no argument? It's the lack of the signature? Is that what you're arguing about?
It's a little more than that, but it's the fact that the record is devoid of any evidence that there was a supervising attorney present that day.
But doesn't that hurt your case if the record is devoid? Simply not having an appearance of record doesn't mean that the attorney wasn't sitting in the galley, wasn't available. In the Court of Appeals, we have supervising attorneys that are sitting with the spectators. They're there to supervise the attorney. So how can we make that distinction?
Because of the importance we put on the plea process, it needs to be recorded. We all but require these petitions.
But your client has not made an assertion or a claim that there was no one supervising within the courtroom. We just don't have any record. We have nothing showing that he was objecting and saying, here's the student, there's nobody here to watch or supervise. Don't we need that?
At the time he entered the plea, is that what the court's?
Yes.
Yeah, no, there's no record of that then. He was under the impression.
How do we disprove, how would the state ever be able to disprove a negative? I mean, what you're suggesting, and the reason I'm a little put out, is you're almost asking for a roll call of everyone that's present in the courtroom before a guilty plea is entered to make sure that the victim was contacted and the victim was there and the victim's representative. And you could have a litany of folks that may be affected by the outcome of a guilty plea that don't necessarily appear on a transcript record of a Rule 15.
And Your Honor, I don't want any of that, but I want the record to reflect that a licensed attorney, and I think it's the good rule of law.
All right, then my question, just so I'm clear, you aren't objecting to the totality of the Rule 15 petition. In fact, we've all read that in the transcript. It appears to be quite thorough. Do you find any error in the Q&A supporting the Rule 15 petition other than the fact that a supervising attorney is not there?
No, facially, the petition and the process in court was fine. The analogy we're using here is that, let's say, a Joe Schmo off the street, a realtor that had never practiced law, came in, advised Mr. Miner to plead guilty, walked him up to the podium, and then they went through the plea process. So that's a straight Sixth Amendment violation, right?
Well, that's an unauthorized practice of law, and I mean, you have recourse as far as that avenue, but I'm interrupting. Go ahead.
No, Your Honor, no, and that's because that's the crux of the case, is we've got case law on both sides talking about somebody who has never gone to law school, and then we've got somebody who was disbarred or had their license suspended. This falls somewhere in the middle, and that's why I emphasize the language in the Smith case that talks about how, you know, if this person had never been licensed, there'd absolutely be no question that they can't be doing things in court. And then they talk about the fact that we require attorneys to have graduated from accredited law schools and passed the bar, and they've got that extra supervision from the court. And that's why I'm saying here, it sounds like a formality, but I think it really goes to the public trust in the system. Many people call me and they talk about how they have a public pretender. And I know some attorneys let that go, and I correct them on the spot. I hate that phrase. But there's that real perception that you're getting shoved through the system with a public defender as your attorney. And now we're a step removed where it's not only not a full-fledged attorney, but it's a student attorney. I think it's very important.
So the gist of this is the formality of the rules of student practice versus your client claiming that his guilty plea was not knowingly and intelligently made. Or is that too broad?
No, that's it. It's the validity of the plea. And I liken it to collateral attacks on, like, for example, in the DWI context, the Nordstrom case allows you to attack a prior conviction that was not entered with the assistance of counsel. And if the record is blank, try to get that transcript and you can't find it, or there's no petition entered into the court file.
But then we go back to my initial assertion, which is where I'm frankly a little put out. We don't have rosters. Maybe that's what's going to come down the road with the new era we're in, where you have everyone checking in at the door and identifying themselves in the courtroom, because I would trust that a district court judge is going to make certain that any rules of practice are being complied with in his or her courtroom, and that would include presence in the courtroom of the supervising attorney. So why do we default to your client that just because there wasn't a check-in of everyone that was there, that there was some constitutional misstep in terms of the representation?
And my argument is that it's that important, and it's that simple for the record to reflect Crystal Humboldt's certified student attorney under the guidance of so-and-so. I mean, that's
so what do you want us to do? Should we send it back to the district court and have the student attorney examined as to whether or not was supervised or to create some record? I mean, what do you think should happen? What are you driving us to issue as far as an opinion or determination on this matter?
Mr. Minor is asking for the district court's decision to be reversed for a ruling of law that there needs to be some evidence that he was actually represented by either an attorney or the person that was representing him followed all of the requirements of being a certified student attorney, especially when entering an enhanceable plea.
All right, so we are having these video arguments today. How do I know you're an attorney? I haven't had you hold up your identification showing me your number. How do I know you're an attorney? How do I know you're not an imposter? Because I can't see you except on the video screen. So how is the record from this Court of Appeals hearing going to reflect that we have a licensed attorney to practice law in the state of Minnesota appearing on our WebEx?
Honestly, it won't. And if I was an imposter, there would be a record to try to track me down. It's an interesting question.
You have an honest looking face, so we'll take your word for it.
Yes. No, it's and I would look into that Mr. Archambault character while we're at it. I understand the court's concern is that you're afraid we're adding too much complexity and it's a slippery slope. I think it's just that important. I mean, we're not talking about a simple waiver. I mean, this is a complex waiver where I have to ask a client multiple questions. And even before we get to that point, there's supposed to be a detailed discussion. I have the time to do that with my clients. And it's all about the public perception. Was there?
Yes, I have a question. And I just want to follow up with a question that was put to you by Judge Werke.
Are using student attorneys in lieu of fully licensed attorneys regularly. And part of that is honestly, it's a caseload concern.
And do you have any authority anywhere that supports the adoption of such a per se rule?
Well, it comes down to a conglomeration of cases. There is the Nordstrom case that makes it clear that all of the elements of an appropriate plea need to be on the record, or it can't use that to enhance a subsequent case. And then we've got the Smith case, the holding that talked about an attorney who lost their license and how that wasn't a manifest injustice. And then the strongly worded dicta in that case that drew the line very brightly and referred to other persuasive authority, where if it's somebody that never graduated law school, an accredited law school, and passed the bar, we've got a different standard. And this case is in the middle, because this is somebody that does have not only some legal training, but you know, there's rules of practice governing how they operate. But
does this position of yours run afoul with the present pilot initiatives to expand the practice of law to paralegals and to no longer have licensed attorneys doing transactional work or work on behalf of the clients? They seem to be incompatible.
I don't think so. And it's because, and I might not be doing the best job of this, but it's just the plea process is so important. It ranks right up there with a trial. And when
I would be more sympathetic if the elements of the plea, if there was something that you could point out that was starkly remiss or something of that nature. But I was impressed by the student attorney. And that's why I asked you that question. So it really, from your perspective, is just the overall importance, the arching importance of the Rule 15.
Yeah, if there was something wrong with the plea, if he had not waived his right to trial or his right to confrontation, like that would be our argument. But no, the plea is there. And, you know, a realtor that never went to law school and just got their realtor's license could have done the exact same job here. And the Smith case addresses that too.
Like, but the realtor would not have been under the quote student practice rule. And we do have indicia of student practice rule that comes in with the materials.
Yes. No, and we're not, I mean, to take it even further, we're not alleging that Ms. Humboldt wasn't a student attorney. It's just the fact that there's nothing reflecting the fact that she was actually following the rules of student practice.
I'm sorry, whenever it's appropriate, Judge Hooten, let me know. I have a question.
Well, you go ahead. You go first.
So I have a much more basic question, Mr. Noller. I mean, this is a post-conviction proceeding. The law is clear at the Court of Appeals. We do not presume error, and the burden is upon the petitioner to show error. What in the record shows that error occurred here? Can you point us to?
The fact that there is no reflection that there was a supervising attorney participating in any aspect of the entry of the plea.
That would seem to me to be a failure on your part, on your burden, to not to show that there's wasn't a lawyer there, as opposed to this kind of vague presumption that that there wasn't.
And I would respectfully disagree.
I figured you would, but
my timer went off.
Well, you will have 5 minutes for a rebuttal.
And Your Honor, because my time is expiring, I'd like to think about your question and see if I can come up with a suitable response on rebuttal.
Thank you.
The respondent may now proceed.
Good morning, Your Honor. Counsel, may it please the court. My name is Derek Archambault. I represent the respondent, State of Minnesota, City of Woodbury, in the case before the court this morning, and fervently hope the court finds my face to be just as trustworthy as Mr. Kohler's.
I can't speak for the rest of the panel, but yes, and let's go. Let's get to my initial question. Are you conceding that we should address the merits of this? I mean, you didn't bring anything up on the evaporation of time, the timeliness of this petition. Are you conceding that today, or do you think we should just dismiss it as being untimely?
I think it should be dismissed as untimely, Your Honor. It is true that is an issue that was not thoroughly addressed by the parties. I do believe it was touched on by both parties. It was also directly raised by the district court. And I think part of the reason that it was not really thoroughly fleshed out is because this was presented as a motion under Rule 15 of the Rules of Criminal Procedure to withdraw a guilty plea. And that was the incorrect legal authority. This should have been raised as a motion for post-conviction relief under Chapter 590.
I just thought of something, Mr. Archambault. Were you the prosecutor on this case?
No, I was not present either at the initial plea or at the motion hearing.
Would you agree with me that a prosecutor as an officer of the court would be required ethically to alert the hearing judge if there was something amiss as far as a unlicensed attorney practicing in that courtroom?
Absolutely, yes. Certainly, and I can, you know, this certainly isn't in the record, but I can tell the court from personal experience, I deal with certified student attorneys all the time. As a municipal prosecutor with misdemeanor and gross misdemeanor caseloads, those are most frequently the sort of cases that student certified attorneys participate in. And so it's a process that I'm familiar with that I deal with every single day. And absolutely, if I had any reason to believe there was something amiss, I would have an ethical obligation, and I certainly would do that, to raise that to the court. Your Honor, the procedural aspects of this case, I really think because it was presented in the way that it was missed. The two-year timeline should have been directly brought to the court's attention. It was not. But the fact of the matter is, this motion should have been presented as a motion for post-conviction relief. It was not. And if it had been, the timeliness issue would have been apparent to all. Chapter 590 sets forth a two-year requirement for a motion of this type, and there are a number of exceptions. None of those apply here. They would need to be affirmatively raised by the moving party, which was not done in this case. And so that alone should end the court's analysis. This motion needed to be brought within 2 years. It was brought 7 years after sentencing, after the case lingered in warrant status for 6 years. And I think that's important too. Not only the timeline, but the fact that during that time frame, the petitioner effectively absconded from supervision. The case was in warrant status. He took no steps whatsoever to bring this to the court's attention or to further the case in any sense. And that matters under Chapter 590 because of the two-year requirement. It matters under Rule 15, which requires a motion be timely. And it also matters just as a matter of equity here, because what petitioner is effectively asking the court to do is dismiss this case. It is not realistically triable anymore. An enormous amount of time has passed. Memories have faded. Retention periods for critical electronic evidence, things like squad videos, are gone now because we don't save them for that period of time, particularly when a defendant has pled guilty and accepted responsibility for their offense.
You know, and I understand all your arguments now, but why prohibited the state from making those arguments at the time of the post-conviction motion?
I'm sorry, Judge, you broke up. I didn't catch all that.
But what prohibited the state from making all of these arguments at the time that the matter was raised as a post-conviction matter?
Well, it wasn't raised as a post-conviction matter, which I think was part of the problem, but they were raised. Counsel at the motion hearing did address the timeliness and the prejudice that lack of timeliness and the extreme delay here caused to the state. So I do think they were raised. I do concede they should have been addressed more directly and more thoroughly, but certainly they were touched upon. So again, just on the timeliness issue alone, there's ample basis for the court to uphold the district court's decision. Now, as to the merits of the argument, the petitioner is effectively asking the court, the entirety of his argument, ask this court to equate the circumstance in this case, which he alleges was an uncounseled or unsupervised student-certified attorney, with an imposter. And in particular, he kind of seizes upon the definition of an imposter in the Smith court as one who has never been admitted to the practice, admitted to the bar. But the fact of the matter is there are a number of very important distinctions between the two scenarios that make that comparison completely inapplicable. Those are discussed by the courts, but consider, you know, an imposter attorney may never, under any circumstance whatsoever, rely on a client. An imposter attorney is not subject to court discipline or supervision or ethical standards. An imposter attorney may have an incentive to conceal their true nature and thereby jeopardize the effectiveness of their representation. An imposter has never had any degree of trust bestowed in him or her by the judicial system. An imposter is committing a crime by his or her representation of a client. And in the scenario of an imposter, it directly implicates and jeopardizes public trust in the integrity of the judicial system. I didn't make that list up. All those things are pulled from the Smith and Salina decisions as factors that the courts considered when analyzing this issue. But none of those factors apply to the circumstance of a student-certified attorney who can, in fact, represent clients under appropriate circumstances, is subject to court supervision and discipline, and has had some degree of trust bestowed on them inherent in the fact that they have been student certified by the courts. And so all those distinctions are important, and they completely undermine the argument that the ruling, the really extreme remedy that the Salina court applied in that fact scenario, should apply here.
You know, I understand the distinction you're making, but I mean, wouldn't it have been a real easy matter for the state, or even the court, to acknowledge that this is a student, a certified student attorney, and that, that attorney is under the supervision of a particular public defender? I mean, how hard is that to do during a proceeding? And otherwise, if that had been done, we wouldn't be here for that.
It's not hard to do. And you're right, that would probably be best practice. It would have relieved us all of a lot of work and effort in this case and saved a few trees. But the reality is the remedy that's being requested here is an extreme one. And it was justified only very reluctantly in the Salina case by those very extraordinary circumstances. And those circumstances simply are not present here. And the other important fact here, and it's been touched upon during Mr. Kohler's arguments and discussions with the court, is that this is a motion by his client for post-conviction relief. It is his motion, and it is his burden. And throughout the argument and the briefing, the circumstance here has been repeatedly referred to as a plea entered by an unsupervised certified student attorney. But we don't know that that's true. The record does not establish that. And in fact, if we look at the student rules or the rules of student practice, it's not required in the rules that supervisory counsel make an appearance on the record. So it's not even clear that there was any sort of violation of the student practice rules here. And that's important because it's his burden to demonstrate that. This court cannot assume the very critical fact that it is petitioner's burden to prove by a preponderance of the evidence. He has not presented that evidence. And in fact, again, had the motion been presented under Chapter 590, it would have been very clear to all that he had the opportunity to present evidence to supplement his motion. Chapter 590 explicitly permits the court to consider additional evidence via affidavit, testimony, or other sources. It's very permissive. And the record could have been supplemented, but it was not. And failure to do so has to fall on petitioner because he's not carried his burden. Fundamentally, the record in this case shows no hint of deficient or ineffective representation. As the court noted, the student certified attorney in this job really did a very fine job. I've seen worse by licensed attorneys. I'm confident this court has as well. Petitioner was very much thoroughly apprised of his rights, and he knowingly and voluntarily waived those rights. He has not claimed, and he cannot show prejudice, and he most certainly cannot show a manifest injustice that would justify the extreme remedy he's requesting of this court. And yet he asked this court for that extreme remedy, the extreme remedy of his plea being declared presumptively invalid based on a technical violation of the rules, which he has not even proven actually occurred. Your Honors, because of petitioner's failure to present this issue in a timely manner, because of his failure to present a persuasive legal argument in support of his position, and because of his failure to prove the facts that he alleges support his position, I am respectfully requesting the court to affirm the district court's denial of his motion. If the court has any questions, I'd be happy to take them. Otherwise, I have nothing further.
Anyone? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ms. Kohler, you may have 5 minutes for rebuttal. And if you want to begin by answering Judge Flory's question to you, that would be fine.
Thank you, Your Honor. No, in answer to your question, it's always difficult to prove an absence. But in this case, petitioner did show, or appellant did show, that there was no attorney on the record, no licensed attorney signed the petition. And when Mr. Archambault talked about how the attorney doesn't have to be in the courtroom, under the student rules, if that's going to happen, there needs to be a signed written authorization. There's also no evidence of that. I keep referring to
North. I don't know that he said that he doesn't have to be in the courtroom for the supervisor. What I was hearing, and I hope I was hearing, is that there doesn't need to be a record made of that.
Well, according to the student rules, I believe that they don't have to be at the appearance if they provide written authorization. But if I misstated what Mr. Archambault said, I'll apologize to him now and later. But so that much was proven. It's been as proven as much as you could that there wasn't a supervisor there. At a certain point, you need to, I believe the appropriate method for handling this, the rule of law, would be establishing that there was a student attorney practicing, and there's no evidence in the record, no written authorization from the supervising attorney that they were there. At that point, the burden should shift to the state to actually bring forth affirmative evidence that there was a supervising attorney there.
Isn't it classic law, though? If you're bringing the post-conviction motion, isn't the burden upon the moving party?
Initially, yes. The burden could shift.
I want to get to the essence of this, too. You're asking us to adopt a per se rule. What exactly would you have us adopt? How would that syllabus read on any adoption of the per se rule?
Well, and I'll start with the candid admission. So let's assume Ms. Humboldt absolutely was unsupervised, that she just went in there that day and handled the calendar. If this court isn't willing to say that that's a Sixth Amendment violation, the manner of proof almost doesn't matter.
All right. So you're basically asking us to adopt a per se rule that if a student attorney is unsupervised, then that is not adequate representation. Is that correct?
That would be a manifest injustice. That's the core rule. That's the case of first impression we're talking about.
But before we even get to that point, isn't the issue of whether the student attorney was supervised or unsupervised, isn't that a factual issue which would render us or render it unnecessary for us to adopt a per se rule if in fact we do not think you met your burden in showing there is not supervision?
No, and I think on this record, Mr. Minor's counsel did meet that burden. I mean, he did show there was no reflection in the record of a supervising attorney. There was no reflection in the petition of a supervising attorney. And there was no reflection of a written authorization saying that the supervising attorney wasn't going to be present at that appearance. All of that evidence went completely unrebutted by the state. That in and of itself there should meet the burden.
But if we look at the rules of a student attorney, there's been an agreement that attorney will be supervised, and I think the court obviously recognized this attorney, and there may have been numerous hearings involved during that day. As is often the case with very crowded criminal calendars, how do we know the supervising attorney wasn't just in working with another client?
We don't. But
I mean, you're asking us to assume that there was no supervising attorney, and I'm not sure that we're in a position to do that.
Well, and it's certainly not an assumption, because it's borne out by every absence noted by appellant's counsel in the record. Like, everything shows that this person wasn't there. So I think the assumption,
doesn't just show they didn't state on the record who the supervising attorney was. I mean that it doesn't necessarily show that.
And I see that I'm out of time. May I answer the question?
Yes, you may.
No, and the assumption that everybody is making is that the supervising attorney was there. And because of the ethical rules and how we do things, I mean, that's not an unfair assumption, but that is the assumption that's being made when the record has no evidence. Three pieces of evidence that could have demonstrated a supervising attorney was there all don't. And I think on that record, it's not fair to assume that the supervising attorney was there, not when it comes to the importance of entry of plea.
Well, thank you. Any other questions?
No.
All right, very good. Thank you. We will take the matter under advisement and issue an opinion within the statutory period of time. Thank you very much for your presentations here today. Very interesting case.